from Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. And here are the issues. The military chief of the United States said combating the terrorist group Islamic State will require the fight to be extended beyond Iraq and into Syria. In Gaza, Israeli airstrikes kill three top Hamas military leaders. In eastern Ukraine, fighting between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian separatists continued as Russian President Vladimir Putin planned to meet with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. And in Ferguson, Missouri, where an unarmed black man was shot to death by a white police officer, tension appeared to ease as the Missouri National Guard began withdrawing from the riot-torn suburb of St. Louis. Well, David, I'm going to start with you. You know, these airstrikes ordered by President Obama in Iraq have been very limited. They seem to have been effective, but limited. I'm not sure whether when the military chief, General Dempsey, says, hey, we're going to have to go into Syria, too, because this terrorist group does lap over the border, pretends like there's no border there. Do you think President Obama's up for this, really expanding the war?
Well, I think if it was a question of the American military openly saying, we, the United States, are going to have to go into Syria, then that would be a huge political crisis, because I don't think that's where the politics of this are at the moment. But I think if you look at his words, he's talking about a coalition that will need to be formed. So
it had to be succinct in my
exactly. No, I'm not criticizing your phrasing, but I think it's important to say, there is a gigantic difference, even in terms of international law, between America launching airstrikes over targets in Iraq and over targets in Syria. Mm-hmm. It matters a lot to any government, particularly to one led by a cautious constitutional lawyer like President Obama, that the Iraqi government has invited America in to conduct these airstrikes. So there's no question about having to go to the United Nations for a mandate. You don't need to have the Arab League way. Mm-hmm. It's a domestic event where the Iraqi sovereign government invites America to give it help, effectively for America to be the Iraqi Air Force or the Peshmerga's Air Force. Attacking targets in Syria, and certainly anything that looks like even special forces on the ground in Syria, that I think is a gigantic difference. That's an invasion of a sovereign country. And then that raises the whole very ugly question, which I think we're going to see more and more debate about. Are we now on President Assad's side to any extent? Because let's not forget, standing American policy is for President Bashar Assad of Syria to stand down because he's a bloodthirsty tyrant, but he is one of the most effective forms of opposition to the same ISIS fighters in Syria that we are fighting in Iraq.
It does appear the answer to that is yes.
Well, I think there are politicians who are certainly saying, in America, also back in Europe, you're seeing some conservative politicians particularly saying, let's just get real. Assad, you know, we don't like him. We're going to have to eat some crow. You know, it's going to be very unpleasant admitting that actually we need him now. But we need him now. You know, we're on the same side of this fight against ISIS, who are the single largest threat in this region. I'm not sure, and Tim has a much better sense of the congressional politics than I do on this, I'm not sure that's where the kind of consensus is yet, that we're about to sort of openly embrace the Syrian regime of Assad as an ally against ISIS in this fight.
Well, David asked you a good question. I don't even need to be here, Tim. But, of course, Congress is not in session now, and the Pentagon has just let out the idea that we may have to expand the airstrikes into Syria. What do you expect the congressional reaction is going to be? I guess we'll hear some in August, but we'll probably hear a lot more when Congress reconvenes in September.
Yeah, I mean, when David talks about how cautious this former constitutional lawyer and professor, President Obama, is, I think that extends doubly for Congress, which is not exactly eager to authorize new strikes. But I think David also makes a very interesting point about the calculus here and whether the enemy of our enemy is our friend. And I don't think that is something that Congress is ready to embrace at all. And if behind the scenes diplomats are making that kind of calculation, you'll never hear it expressed in Congress that, for example, Assad is on our side in any way. I mean, that is just not palatable to any politician to say on the record. And I think the thing that is, I'm sure, worrying a lot of people in the White House and Congress is that the president campaigned and was elected on his promise to end two foreign wars. The problem is that the world has dragged him back in despite his best efforts. He's promised since the start of this latest intervention, just hundreds of advisors in Iraq, that there wouldn't be mission creep, that the objectives of this mission would not expand over time. But we're seeing that it's impossible for that not to happen. When you send hundreds of advisors into Iraq, you need to protect them when they're threatened. And now, after advisors were sent in, then come airstrikes. After airstrikes happen, now we're talking about the expansion of those airstrikes or perhaps creating a coalition to expand them outside of Iraq. This sort of thing, it seems, is inevitable.
And I think what's missing, sorry,
I
think what's missing is we haven't yet had a kind of full-throated debate about whether ISIS, the Islamic State, these horrible fanatical jihadists, do they in and of themselves represent a threat to America's national security interests? And I think that to me is one of the sort of sticking points at the moment. So I was recently, about 10 days ago, on a trip as a reporter with the Defense Secretary, Chuck Hagel, and it was extraordinary seeing his trip, which was all supposed to be about trade and diplomacy with India, being kind of blindsided by the events from Iraq, and suddenly it all became about Iraq. Even at those early stages when they were announcing, this was at the days they started the airstrikes in the north of Iraq, there was a contradiction between, on the one hand, Secretary Hagel, the head of the Pentagon, saying they pose an enormously grave threat to the stability of Iraq, we cannot do nothing, and then describing, as you say, Fred, the incredibly narrow parameters of why strikes will be conducted. Mm-hmm. At that time, you know, to protect this particular group of the Yazidi minority on a mountain in Sinjar, and then specifically blocking IS fighters who might be trying to make it to the Kurdish capital, Erbil. So you had this extraordinary contradiction between the breadth of the threat described and the narrowness of the measures being prescribed. And when you talked to the kind of the generals in the entourage behind the scenes, and you said, well, what if they don't go up the road to Erbil, turn the other way, are they still worth hitting at all? Do they in and of themselves represent a national security threat? They would say, well, you put your finger on the political debate which hasn't yet finished in Washington. I think that explains a lot of the kind of uncertainty about where we're going to go next with this.
Here's what we haven't mentioned, and that, of course, is the highly publicized and visible beheading by ISIS of James Foley. And then you have General Martin Dempsey, which is interesting to me. He has been a head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon who has been extremely, has gotten on better, I think, than most Chiefs of Staff do with the president, particularly this president. And it's hard for me to believe that he would sort of outflank the president on this idea of extending the fight. Tim?
Well, yeah, the president gave a very passionate speech after it came out that Mr. Foley had been decapitated by ISIS forces. But there was very little in that speech that indicated what precisely he would do to avenge the death of an American overseas. He seemed very angry about it, and it later came out through White House sources that the United States had launched a rescue operation in an attempt to rescue Foley and other Americans, but were unsuccessful. I mean, probably from some of the frustration stemmed from that. But what we're really not seeing is what this president intends to do precisely about this anger that he's expressing. There have been limited airstrikes, but there is a disparity, like David was saying, there is a disparity between what the very narrow parameters of what we're currently doing and the rhetoric and the way we're shaping this threat. Mm-hmm. If the threat is as large as American officials are saying it is, why aren't we doing something about it? That's the question that people are asking, and probably one that will explain an expansion in objectives later.
I think so far why we're not doing, we meaning the United States, doing anything is the president up to now has been, this is exactly what he wanted to avoid, exactly the kind of thing, expanding American military action in the Middle East or anywhere.
And, you know, you can criticize, and in my own newspaper, The Economist, we have criticized President Obama for, you know, we would have liked to see him, you know, do more to arm the moderate rebels in Syria early on and stuff. But
you mentioned that that a couple of weeks ago, the question on the on the cover.
Yeah, what would America fight for? Yeah. And we got quite a lot of pushback from the administration.
But
here's the thing. To be fair to him, there isn't anyone standing up in Washington and saying, point one, I denounce the president for his weakness. Point two, here is my brilliant shopping list of things that would work. I mean, there isn't a long menu of options which we are sure would actually fight IS, because the Islamic State is I mean, I think the president described it as a cancer, and that's mm-hmm. right. It is something that sort of, it metastasizes. It sucks in extra sort of jihadists from around the world, from around the West. Mm-hmm. It grows organically in and of mm-hmm. itself. It's not something that you can bomb in submission. You can't kill. There aren't enough people to kill to make it go away. That's not how it's going to go away. You can't bomb it into mm-hmm. submission. And so there are no very attractive options. And I remember, you know, before this latest crisis started, someone from the White House saying fairly passionately, look at the moment when there was the peak of American troops in Iraq. And that was also the moment when you had the peak of sectarian killings in Iraq. Mm-hmm. They have destruction tested the thesis that you can send hundreds of thousands of American troops into Iraq and make jihadist fighters go away.
David, I know you've been home to the UK in recent hours, actually. How has this gone down? Is it a big issue with on the video, we see the man who chopped off the head of James Foley. He seems to speak with a British accent.
He speaks with an East London accent. Yeah, it's a big issue, not just for parochial reasons, because this appears to be horrendously a British, at least resident or national, who did this. Also, this is the nightmare of every intelligence service for the last several years, that you have these fighters being sucked in by the, sort of the dark, horrible allure of this kind of jihadist extremism, people with British passports, people with European passports. And let me make the point, I mean, clearly, if you have a British passport and you go and do this, you can enter the United States tomorrow with no visa.
Mm-hmm.
You just get on the plane. So there are no controls for people with British passports to come to the US unless their name is on some watch list already. They just mm-hmm. they get on the plane. And so this is unbelievably alarming. And you saw on the front page of the British newspapers, the British Prime Minister cutting short his summer holiday, coming to Downing Street mm-hmm. for crisis meetings, intelligence services in the UK trying to use voice recognition to analyse if they can work out who this guy is, who he's dealing with. They think there are 500 British citizens currently in Syria and Iraq fighting with Islamic State. That's a pretty scary number. They think 500 or so, yeah.
Mm. Well, all of those...
Maybe not with IS. Fighting as jihadists in Syria and Iraq.
Right. If the British do not know who this executioner is, then he's probably not on a no-fly list.
They're saying, I mean, for what it's worth, the latest reporting from the UK was they think that it's going to be relatively easy to work out who he is. If they're already watching him, then they can pick him up. Who knows if that's true?
Okay. Tim, let's turn to a second story, and that is the killing of three of the top Hamas military leaders in Gaza by Israeli airstrikes. Now, in the past, I think it's been generally agreed that Hamas and then, in fact, terrorist organizations have been able to promote people they already have, and it hasn't really been a huge disaster when their top military leaders have been killed. Might it be different this time?
There's no indication that it would be different this time, but I think we have to look at this in the context of the recent violence between Israel and Gaza. I think Israel believes that after its latest operation in the Strip, that it has created a real deterrence for Hamas to act out in the future in any substantial or largely operational way. That Israel thinks that they might have some deterrence, that Hamas might be deterred for several years based on the route that they got in Gaza.
Hmm. David?
I think what's interesting is clearly, you know, you have to assume that it hurts them to take out some of their top people. I mean, even if there's, you know, a lot of, you know, people willing to take their place, you have to assume it's worth doing. I think what's fascinating, though, is that this, you know, military victory for the Israeli Defense Forces comes at the same time that we saw this diplomatic initiative from some pretty close allies in Europe of the Israelis, France, Germany and the UK, essentially proposing, as far as we can tell, to go to the UN Security Council and get the UN Security Council to sign off on basically the plan they want the Israelis to agree to, which is to have Hamas surrender their control of the Gaza Strip to the Palestinian Authority in exchange mm-hmm. for a lifting of the blockade, the 7-year blockade on the Gaza mm-hmm. Strip. Now, that's basically the deal that's on the table in the talks between Israel and Hamas in Cairo. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere there. So basically mm-hmm. Hamas and Israel are not interested in this deal, but it is, I think, pretty significant that two permanent members of the Security Council mm-hmm. are putting this deal on the table in New York. Mm-hmm. And I think what that shows mm-hmm. you is even as Israel mm-hmm. is making breakthroughs on the military side, and as Tim says, that can have value, mm-hmm. Israel is not winning the diplomatic war with its own allies at mm-hmm. the moment. They're being somewhat sort of hemmed around by their own allies, clearly not the United States. The United States always in a different place, but certainly some very close European allies putting a lot of pressure on Israel to change tack.
I have one more question about this. You know, the intelligence that the Israelis had in killing these three top military leaders was obviously pretty good. And I'm not making any assumptions that they heard it from some Palestinian or something, but am I on to something here that we're seeing dissent by the people in Gaza manifest itself in ways like the killing of these three military leaders, or am I reaching for something?
I mean, the Israelis might like to think that. I think it's very hard to gauge Palestinian opinion in this area. And there are two arguments to it. I mean, that if you look at the years at which Hamas has been, the authorities in the Gaza Strip have not been good years for the people who live there, not at all. I mean, and that one of their main goals has been the confrontation between Hamas and Israel. But on the other hand, the recent operation by Israel has been very disruptive for your ordinary Gaza. And lots of innocent civilians killed, lots of women and children wounded or just outright killed. And that works to Hamas's favor as well. I mean, I don't think that there are a lot of Gazans that are particularly happy with Israel or ready to throw Hamas under the bus just for the fact of it.
Yeah, it's sort of tough being a human shield, being used by Hamas.
And then the final leg of this, I think, and I worry I sound like a sort of Foreign Office diplomat in my sort of striped trousers and bowler hat here.
That's why you're here.
I hope that's not
just
true.
Kidding,
I
just
hope that's
kidding.
Not true. If part of the calculation in Israel is that by inflicting horrible suffering on Gaza and this extremely kind of severe retaliation for the Hamas strikes is to drive a wedge between the Palestinian public and Hamas, because as Tim says, it has been miserable for them, that's a reasonable calculation to make in strategic terms. But the other half of that is they have to do much more to stand up some sort of moderate Palestinian authority to talk to. You can't say, you can't have Hamas, forget Hamas, abandon Hamas, but we're going to do nothing to strengthen an alternative Palestinian roots. The Palestinians have to have some form of government. Yeah. And I think there's a grave criticism I would make that, well, the economists would make, I mean, not me, that Benjamin Netanyahu and his government in Israel have undermined the Palestinian Authority, who are the alternative. You can't attack Hamas and not leave them with an alternative.
I'm going to have one more question about that. But first, let me take a break and remind listeners, this is Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes. Joining me today are Tim Mack of The Daily Beast and David Rennie of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. David, you mentioned this effort to get Hamas and Israel to agree to a deal. The hard part, it's hard for me to believe that the Israelis will lift the blockade, you can go to the UN. Is a deal really possible?
I think lifting the blockade has got to be one of the hardest things to do, and particularly even here in Washington. There's any number of members of Congress, Tim knows better than I do, who will say, you know, look at what was coming through during the years of the blockade. It turned out that all the construction materials that Israel was trying to block, they had a good reason to be blocking them because they were being used to make tunnels to attack Israeli citizens, and the rockets were coming through. And so I think that the idea of Israel having a legitimate security interest in maintaining a very tight kind of grip on what goes in and out of Gaza is very live in Israeli politics, very live in American politics. But you come back to this problem, which is that you can't kill your way to peace in this region. You know, there has to be a solution at some point. And if you want the people of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank to turn away from the most extreme forces in Hamas, you have to do something to build up the moderate alternative. And perhaps not on the blockade. Perhaps the blockade is a sticking point in the moment. But, you know, we get back to all the other issues about, you know, Israeli military occupation of the West Bank, the settlement construction, all of the things that have sort of flawed all previous peace efforts. They don't go away. They don't improve, but they don't go away.
Tim, one more question on this, and that is, David talks about Israel losing diplomatically, in Europe in particular. There hasn't been a lot of criticism of the Israelis in the United States, particularly on Capitol Hill.
No, not at all. I mean, there still remains a very rock-solid coalition of lawmakers that will support Israel, not on every issue, but on most issues, and particularly when it comes to their security. You won't find a lot of argument, not even from very liberal Democrats. I think there's a realization that you don't want to cross people, supporters of Israel.
All right, we're going to change issues here and go back to Ukraine. I say go back because we talk about this every week. The Russian so-called humanitarian convoy has now crossed into Ukraine. The Ukrainians have called it an invasion. No progress seems to be made there. Supposedly, the president of Russia and the Ukraine are going to meet in a few days. I'm not sure that's going to help either, David.
Well, it's not just the Ukrainians who are saying that this feels like an invasion. You have mm-hmm. this convoy of hastily repainted Russian military trucks, now painted white and looking like a humanitarian convoy.
You weren't fooled.
Well, you know, I assume that there are kind of diapers on board as opposed to sort of sure. rocket-propelled grenades. But nonetheless, you know, we know who drives these trucks. Mm-hmm. And it's not just, you know, if it was only the Ukrainians saying they were feeling paranoid, we maybe would say, well, you know, that's just them. But we've had people like the foreign minister of France saying, you know, the real fear is that these trucks roll into the besieged mm-hmm. Rebel-held city of, say, Luhansk, which mm-hmm. is right on the edge of the fighting at the moment. And it turns out you've now got a whole bunch of Russians there creating facts on the ground, and they choose not to leave because they're now there to protect the people of Luhansk from the government forces. The background to this, of course, being that after months and months of victories for the Russian armed and backed separatists, the Ukrainian central government has actually been scoring some successes and has been rolling back some of the separatists, and there's been some very tough fighting in some of these disputed cities right on the edge of control like Luhansk. And that seems to be, you know, a lot of the genesis of these latest maneuverings is that actually the Russian-backed separatists are potentially going to be humiliated in some of these places. And if you humiliate them, you humiliate Vladimir Putin, and he's not someone who takes humiliation well.
He certainly doesn't. And Tim, it's hard for me to believe that Putin is ready or willing to give up on the separatists. Russia's backed them. He's talked about, recreating the Soviet Empire and so on, that I think he's in this for a long run, and we're going to be talking every week. Sometimes other issues overshadow it, but we're going to be talking about the Ukraine and the Russian intrusion and all these things forever.
Well, in a way, I mean, Putin has already achieved one of the main objectives of this entire ordeal, which is to prevent a united Ukraine from shifting its allegiances towards Europe, that he's managed to kind of divide the country in a way that a lot of people, I mean, no one really expected. And even if rebels that are supportive of the Russian government have scored some wins, it does look like they're being pushed back now.
All right, let's turn to Ferguson, Missouri. And this has become a very big story, of course, where an unarmed 18-year-old black man was shot six times, as it turns out, by a white police officer. We still don't know their disputes over exactly what happened and whether the black man who was unarmed was charging at the police officer. There are many different disputes there. But it does seem to, the tension does seem to be easing somewhat. The Missouri National Guard is being pulled out. The Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, has been sent to Ferguson by the president. And Ferguson is an interesting case of a white suburb for years and years that has now become predominantly black, but still has the same white police department that it had before. David, what would you add?
Well, I think that, you know, my own magazine, The Economist, we've written a lot about the militarization of the mm-hmm. American police. And I think that this has been one of the big shocks. I mean, the fact that there mm-hmm. is clumsy and, you know, incompetent policing anywhere in the world is not, you know, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're less good at their jobs. And the details, as you say, we don't yet know. What's been very striking is you've had a lot of national and international media pouring into this place and have just, you know, as reasonable people, have come away stunned by the level of people dressed in combat fatigues, pointing automatic rifles in the faces of completely peaceful protesters. Some of the vehicles that were built to withstand, you know, explosives and mines on the roads of Afghanistan and Iraq have been sold off almost for nothing by the Pentagon to American police departments over the last several years. And you end up with these police forces that look like something out of, you know, the Gulf War. And it's totally inappropriate policing, extremely heavy-handed, and it has a psychological effect. If you stick a cop in combat gear with an automatic rifle in an armored vehicle, mm-hmm. he just is not going to be mm-hmm. the kind of community policing that you need in a place like that.
Well, that is a problem. It's not the core of the story. They're investigations and grand juries looking at it, and they're going to have to come up with something about what happened, actually happened, between
That's
these
right,
two
but
people.
If you're trying to draw broader lessons about what this is symptomatic of, I would say the militarization of the American police, the massive overuse of SWAT teams is a huge problem.
And I think there's increasing agreement on that in public opinion in the United States, that this is not what police forces are supposed to do. They don't need tanks, for instance.
Well, Congress is already looking in September to pass some laws. I mean, one of the major things that has allowed the militarization of the police to occur is that the Pentagon has been handing away surplus military equipment to local law enforcement for a very long time. The reason why we have these mine-resistant vehicles on the road is because they're left over from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Pentagon is willing to give them at very low cost or no cost at all to local law enforcement. But I think the thing to understand about the Ferguson crisis that listeners overseas might not understand is this deep enduring tension between black and white America. We see the militarization of the police, but the real core of this problem is this deep resentment by a lot of African Americans as to how they're treated by police forces, not just in Ferguson, but everywhere across the country, that they feel harassed, that many law enforcement officials are policing in a racist way, targeting them and constantly bothering them, and then shooting an African-American male in the streets. We don't know the facts, like you said. We don't know whether it was justified or unjustified, but it's symptomatic of a larger racial tension that's existed for many, many years.
And you put your finger on something, Fred, when you said that this was a previously white suburb that's now more African-American. You see these very interesting forces where, I mean, for example, some Midwestern cities, they're going now, but they've had laws for many years where police officers had to live in the city that they were policing, and that was intended precisely to prevent, you get this in places like Milwaukee and the Milwaukee suburbs where you have a largely black African-American inner city policed by white police officers who live out in the suburbs. So they don't live in the sort of neighborhoods that they are policing, and you get these very ugly sort of tensions in a lot of these places where you have a black inner city and then the white suburbs.
Well, it's hard for these in Ferguson to fire the white policemen and replace them. At least that's their excuse.
Sure, they're clearly, they've been arresting reporters for asking questions. So I think they probably should. Some of them need to be fired.
Well, that may be true. It's hard to defend this over-militarized Ferguson Police Department, that's for sure. Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Tim Mack, Senior Congressional Correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Will Barber. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.